The push for a half-cent sales tax for schools goes to a vote this week. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this morning, how kids with disabilities are being affected by our aging schools. What are your questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we're celebrating 10 years of First Coast Connect this week. We'll take a look back at how it all began. All of that and more just ahead. But first this morning, the Jacksonville City Council is set to vote tomorrow night on whether to approve a half-cent sales tax referendum to shore up aging local school buildings, some of the oldest in the state. Educators and activists have been speaking out for months now about the need for this dedicated source of funding for schools. At the same time, charter school advocates have been pushing for a carve-out for their schools. However the vote goes down, one issue that's somehow gotten lost in all of this is how school repair and construction are affecting many local children with disabilities. Jacksonville attorney Rebecca Hope represents families of kids with disabilities and joins us now in studio. Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for having me.
What are your questions about the half-cent sales tax referendum for schools? And in particular, we want to hear from families who have children with disabilities. It's 549-2937. Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is open. Okay, Rebecca, you represent parents who have children in the local school system with disabilities, a whole range of disabilities. What are they saying to you about this?
They're saying a couple of things. One of them is that there's a basic need across the board for infrastructure repair. But for kids with disabilities, it affects them a lot more so because they're usually the first classes that are put into the portables. When the buildings are are dilapidated and they have to add more classrooms, the first thing they do is get portables. These portables are not sustainable. They are not strong. They are more prone to mold and mildew. The ramps are often broken. The AC and heat break down tremendously or very loud. And for kids with disabilities, this means that they can't concentrate. They already have difficulty concentrating and learning. They don't need added impediments. It also takes them out of the public school building. The federal law that protects kids with disabilities, the IDEA, requires kids with disabilities to be educated with their peers to the maximum extent possible. And when you take these kids and put them into these portables, that's going directly opposite to what the intention of the law is. And this is not getting it fixed anytime soon. So that's one of the major reasons, I think, is impacting them.
So portables are a big issue for parents, particularly kids who maybe have a learning disability like ADHD or something like that. You're talking about learning disabilities in addition to physical disabilities, right?
Yes. And especially children who have behavioral disabilities and need to be in a smaller classroom, or severe learning disabilities and also need to be taught in smaller classrooms. They're the ones first pushed out. The ones with physical disabilities also have impediments across the board. For instance, one of my clients has described her son has CP and is in a wheelchair, and she has to get him from her minivan into the school building, and there's the parking lot isn't even paved. There's roots, there's sand and everything getting from the car to just the sidewalk. The sidewalk is not handicap accessible, which is fairly ironic because it is the entrance to get all the students who are physically impaired into the building. So they have to somehow get the wheelchair from the sandy parking lot onto the sidewalk. And then when she gets to the door, she has to wait for somebody to help her get the door open and push the chair through because there's not a handicap accessible button to open the door. So these are just like every single morning obstacles for her just to get her child into the building. And this is something that could be easily fixed with funds to fix it.
It's 549-2937 to join us. The other big issue you're hearing from parents about is aging schools don't have up-to-date technology to help students with disabilities, especially wheelchair-bound children. Can you explain what you mean by that?
What I mean, for one instance, is just the button to open the door. That's a pretty basic need, and it's not terribly difficult to put into place. But then there are other issues where kids who have communication disabilities and other ones that facilitated communication options, the schools don't have the technology or enough of the technology. One of the schools, that even at the beach, which is a very nice school in general, they don't have enough computers and TVs for all the students to participate in the learning activities at the same time, which is kind of wasting class time by taking turns rather than having the whole class participate at once. So we're kind of getting behind the eight ball in that way as well.
Okay. Let me ask you as a follow-up, what's your response to the argument we're hearing from supporters of charter schools that they deserve a carve out of these funds for students that don't have disabilities and those that do as well that attend charter schools in this area?
That's a loaded question. So one of the issues that Duval County has is that the average school age, I think, is around 44 years old. Charter schools aren't even 44 years old. So the charter schools in Duval County are even newer. Most of the buildings that they're in are either brand new or fairly new. So their need for the funds for infrastructure is just not as severe and obvious as the ones for the public school. The other issue for me personally as an advocate for kids with disabilities is that charter schools do a great job for a small niche for whatever their charter happens to be in some instances. I'm not a huge proponent of charter schools in general, but mainly because they rarely think about kids with disabilities and how they would fit into their charter, into their school. They have not really addressed those needs, and they don't always think about looking to the district to help them address the needs of kids with disabilities. So for kids with disabilities, it would be disservice greatly by having that kind of proportionate carve out that the council is looking at. It doesn't make much sense because it's not needed there and it doesn't address the kids with disabilities needs.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment. This is one more element to the debate over whether and how voters should get to decide on additional revenue to repair and shore up Duval County's old school buildings, some of the oldest in the state. Give us a call with your thoughts. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. Do we have a number, Rebecca, the number of kids in this community, in the Duval County Public Schools that have a disability? How many kids are we talking about?
That's a good question. I'm not really great with numbers, being an attorney. Numbers are not my not my bailiwick. It's generally about 10% of the population. So it's growing. I mean, one of the largest growing areas of disability is autism, where I think at this point it's one out of 51 or 50. I forget exactly where it is, but it's much stronger population, larger population than it had ever been. And it's kind of growing in disproportionate ways. And that's one of the populations that's being, kind of being shoved off to the side in our communication classes. So that's something we have to keep a look at because it's not going to get smaller. As far as our physical disabilities, we have several different programs around the city, and most of them are in very old schools, and it's difficult to, it's already difficult for these kids to kind of get managed around, but it's more difficult in these older schools.
So autism is a big issue for educators, teaching kids on the autism spectrum, teaching kids with behavioral and learning disabilities, teaching kids in wheelchairs. There's a whole range of issues, right?
And yes.
And as you read through the Duval County Public Schools plan for addressing all of the physical issues at all of the school buildings around town, do you feel that they've adequately addressed the needs of kids with disabilities? If this referendum were to pass, do you have confidence or not that the money that they are hoping to raise would help pay for some of the improvements these kids need?
I think the need is so basic and obvious that it does. I mean, I ironically, my job is to kind of hold them in check by, threatening to sue them for not doing their job for kids with disabilities. But I really do stand behind them on this matter because the need is so basic and so obvious that anything they do is going to be an improvement over what they have now. And I do think that the plan, the council has been asking them questions over and over again. And one of the board members said it's kind of like a game of whack-a-mole. Every time we answer one question, they come up with a different one. And it just doesn't make any sense to me why they can't move forward with the plan they already have, or at least the part of the plan they have, when it's just so obvious that it has to be done. And the council hasn't said it's not needed. They just want something different. They always want something different. But it's time. I mean, it's already a year too late.
It's looking like it may go to a vote next year, not this year. based on what we're hearing from members of the council. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, they did say that it's probably too late for November. There were hopes that it could possibly get put into a vote could be put on December. And I mean, the public outcry has already been pretty obvious and pretty out there. I think UNF did a poll in the spring sometime that there's 70% acceptance of this idea. And it's frustrating to me that the council just seems to be wanting to maintain control over the issue rather than letting the people speak. Let's put it to a vote and let's see what the people say.
Let's go to your calls. It's 549-2937. What are your thoughts about this? How do you think the council should vote? 549-2937. Brandy is on the south side. Hi, Brandy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I was just calling to urge everyone to call their city council members and ask them to push through the voter referendum for the half-cent sales tax. Their schools are falling apart. I know for a fact that Lee High School has had classrooms with no air conditioning for the first two weeks of class. Students have fainted in the classrooms, and I'd like to see city council function without air conditioning and see how quickly it would take for them to pass a referendum to fix their AC.
Brandy, thanks for that. You know, Rebecca, going beyond what you're here to talk about, kids with disabilities, for all children in some of these older schools, the basic issues that we've been hearing so much about, like not having consistently working air conditioning, have led to the intensity, I think, of the discussion around this, right?
Yes, I think there was a report there was 348 work orders for air conditioning before the school started and they hadn't been fixed. And that's just, I mean, nobody, on the way in here, I listened to a story on there's a movement for prisons and their air conditioning. Well, that's great and that's wonderful for inmates. We also need to worry about our kids who don't have air conditioning. They can't think. I think the caller just pointed out, they're fainting in class because there's nowhere to go. So that's just, again, basic need.
Carolyn on the south side. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I just want to say that I do hope that the school tax is passed and that the plans for students with disabilities gets taken care of. I know some of the teachers in some of the schools that are for disabled students, and they are wonderful teachers in the public schools. As for the charter schools, I want to remind everybody that they are not under the elected school board. They have their own school boards, and some of them are not even local. And so we really don't know what their plans are other than they want.
They do have some supervision by the Duval County School Board, though, Carolyn. But I take your point. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Carolyn. Yeah. I mean, for those that haven't followed this closely, Rebecca, charter schools are public schools.
Yes.
So what about the argument that charter schools should get an equitable slice of funding? Critics say they're pushing for a disproportionate slice, given that they are newer buildings and so forth. Proponents say, look, we are public schools, too. It's been difficult for us to raise money sometimes for our kids and our special approaches to education. The argument they're making is one of fairness. What do you say?
So I kind of think that these are two separate issues. And I know that they're intertwined because the half cent sales tax is a political issue. But charter schools, as I mentioned earlier, is a big can of worms in and of itself. And I go back to the fact that most of them are in new buildings. If we're talking about the half cent sales tax going towards infrastructure, the charter schools, by and large, don't have the same need as the public schools, you know, because of their buildings. As a programmatic issue, that's something different. When students leave the public school system, they take those funds and it goes into the charter school. So the charter school gets the funds and the public school loses them. But the public school does not get new students to go in them, and so their funding is less, and we lose special education teachers. They've lost some special education coaches, materials, basic things like traffic people. So now some of the administrators in the schools have to go out and do traffic as opposed to running the school during the drop off and pickup times. And that's because the students are leaving to go to the charter schools. So that's a much bigger issue that I don't think I can really
discuss. Okay.
I can talk an hour on that, but that's not what we're here for today.
Charlotte in the Urban Core. Charlotte, how are you? Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I just want to state that the half cent tax is largely going to affect the greatly ignored Northwest District, which as you mentioned, is the schools that are affected mostly are the oldest schools in Jacksonville. And systemically, these are the mostly Black schools in Jacksonville. And they are also the ignored schools when it comes to infrastructure. So by not updating the infrastructure, we are perpetuating honestly, it's systemic racism in Jacksonville by not allowing these kids to thrive the same way the other districts are getting the same funding for adequate buildings. And as you're mentioning, disability access and quality air control and all of those things.
Thanks, Charlotte. Yeah. Yes, the superintendent, the school board, Rebecca, have brought this up repeatedly, that this is need-based, that they're trying to address some wrongs, some inequities that have gone on for decades in this city in terms of improving schools that are in underserved parts of town. There's a whole range of problems at these schools. And of course, they've circulated a video showing some of the issues. Thanks for that call, Charlotte. Let's go to Teresa. Hi, Teresa. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Hi there. I just want to mention my husband's taught disabled children for a number of years in the middle school areas, and he's disabled himself. He's in a wheelchair. And he's pointed out that the mobile units work really well for the regular teachers, and they've expressed that themselves because it allows them some autonomy in the classrooms and some non-disruption in their classes. However, it's paperwork that seems to overburden him and keep him from teaching as much as he wants in his disabled classes.
Mm-hmm.
He says he'd really like help with the amount of paperwork each disabled student is necessary to keep up and follow their progress.
Thank you for that, Teresa. Rebecca?
Well, that's largely my fault.
Your fault because you're the one suing the county saying, get this up to code, get this up to spec. Okay.
And make sure you had the progress not monitored. And I was a special education teacher for 13 years. I understand that frustration, but I also see it from the other side that accountability is important.
Okay. With all of that said, the vote is set for tomorrow night. A couple of different committees of the city council voted differently on this. The Rules Committee voted to go ahead and advance this. The Finance Committee voted to not. How are you planning to address this with your city council rep? Are you, beyond appearing on this program, are you engaged in lobbying on this issue?
I have not been as much as I should have been, but I think that the first caller made a really great idea or suggestion to call the council person in your area and let them know how you feel. Because it seems obvious to me that the public wants this to happen, but we need to make sure that our council representatives vote our wishes.
Rebecca Hope, attorney for families of children with disabilities. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Much more still ahead, including a look back to the beginnings of First Coast Connect 10 years ago this week. We'll be right back.
Hey, Melissa, David McGowan here. Your voice was literally the first one I heard when I landed in Jacksonville 18 months ago in my rental car. And what I've realized since then is that your show is the most vital, most engaging, the most relevant, and the most important conversation happening here in Jacksonville. Keep going for 10 more. Congratulations.
WGCT's podcast, What It's Like, tells the stories of local people.
I delivered a stillborn baby. The doctors always let you hold them, let you see them, and then they take them away and you never see them again.
Did you feel illegal?
You know, this word is tossed around so loosely.
I did. I kind of felt ashamed sometimes.
Take a listen to What It's Like wherever you get your podcasts.
What can $9.90 get you? Access to the very best in science, nature, and history docs. Introducing WJCT's newest member benefit, PBS Passport Plus Curiosity Stream. Now for the first time, you can get access to all of the great documentaries on PBS's Passport and also get access to the incredible collection of Curiosity Stream, the new documentary service created by the founder of the Discovery Channel. A $9.90 monthly contribution gets you ongoing access to both Curiosity Stream and PBS's Passport service. It's a member benefit unlike any we've ever created and available only from WJZT. Sign up today to get all the documentaries you love anytime, anywhere, on any device. Passport plus Curiosity Stream together for $9.90 per month.
Listen to Pop-Up Country on 89.9 HD4 and explore country, folk, bluegrass, and blues by the musicians who created it as we get ready for Ken Burns' latest documentary, Country Music, coming to WJCT-TV in September.
Welcome back. Well, a group of veterans and gun owners recently penned an op-ed in Newsweek about the gun reform movement. One of them is from this area. Travis Akers is a veteran naval intelligence officer. He also serves on the board of directors for Demcast USA, and he joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. In Newsweek, you spoke out, joining other veterans and also gun dealers and owners from around the country to help prevent the next mass shooting. What compelled you to speak out?
It got to the point to us to realize that enough is enough. And it's said over and over and over again. But this group, we came together knowing that a lot of veterans haven't been speaking out against the gun violence acts. And for us, having that military service, we've handled weapons. We know what proper procedures are for safe handling. We know the training that's involved to be able to use these weapons. And we know the impact of once the trigger is pulled, that that is a permanent act. And so for us, from the veterans' perspective, we came together and formed this working group called Left of Bang. And Left of Bang is a military concept where bang is a violent event. To the right of that event is reaction. Mm-hmm. To the left of that event is prevention. And we want to be on this time continuum, the left of bang. We want to come up with sensible solutions that are going to prevent that bang act from occurring.
And you're calling on gun owners and gun dealers to join you in solutions.
Absolutely. So all five of us in Left of Bang are gun owners. We are current gun owners. We are users. We use them for sporting, for hunting. So we are members of the gun community. And as dealers of weapons are also members of this community, we feel that there is a responsibility within the gun community, gun owners and dealers, to really raise the issues that we think can prevent the next act from happening, because we are supportive of the Second Amendment and we don't want that taken away. So if we want to be able to continue to exercise that constitutional right and to use our weapons, then it is our responsibility to come up with solutions to stop acts from happening that could lead to that.
Okay. And what do you see, along with your working group Left of Bang, as the solutions?
Well, this is a great question, because we think this is a conversation. We don't think right now that there are 100% solutions, but we think there are efforts that can be made. Universal background checks, expanding red flag legislation. We think that ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency, can expand their tip hotline. So if someone is concerned about irresponsible use of weapons or potentially illegal use of weapons, that can be reported and investigated. So we think that there's many areas that are common sense solutions that we can really enact right now that are going to make a tangible difference.
It's 549-2937 as we talk with local veteran Travis Akers. Okay, you mentioned enhanced background checks, red flag laws. They flag someone who might have violent history, prevent them from owning a weapon. That law was passed here in Florida. You talked about ATF's role and the role of various federal agencies in preventing mass shootings. We've learned just in the last few days that something like nearly two dozen mass shooters, potential mass shooters, were apprehended by authorities before they could carry out mass murder. What about that?
Yeah, so that goes into the mantra of if you see something, say something. And here in Florida specifically, there is a Florida tie-in. There was a shooter who was going to go, who had mentioned to a friend, I'm going to go attack a church. And this friend was assertive and proactive and reported it to authorities. And sure enough, that was a prevented shooting, because when authorities arrived to this person's home, it was loaded with all types of weapons and additional magazines. So it's important that we expand the red flag legislation and the laws federally, not just here in Florida. And I know Senator Rubio has bipartisan legislation in right now to do that. And it's something that is that no matter what side of the aisle you're on, and whether you're as staunch of a 2A supporter as possible, or you're just completely anti-gun, it's areas that we can agree on that will make an impact. And I applaud these people who have the willingness and the guts to report it to authorities, because in some cases, this could be your family member. This could be your son. This could be your daughter. This could be a brother. This could be your best friend. But what you're doing is you're valuing life, and you're making that decision that you want to prevent the next mass shooting. So again, if you see something, say something.
In the midst of people speaking out, at the same time, your article in Newsweek says, and I'm quoting, "We must acknowledge that a culture of silence exists within the gun community." What do you mean by that?
A culture of silence exists because of the fear of 2A being taken away, because of this false speaking point in the media that people want to come take our guns away. No one wants to come take our guns away. We want to make sure that they're being used safely and responsibly. And so that's why we feel that in the gun community, so many people have been silent, because of this false fear and because of that thought in the back of their mind that if I speak out, I'm going to be chastised by this community, I'm going to be an outcast, and I'm going to lead to weapons being taken away, when that's not the case at all.
People legitimately fear confiscation of their weapons. And the other reason that the Second Amendment is so emotional for people is many Americans feel that civilians need to be armed in case there's ever a need to overthrow a tyrannical government. Now, you served in the military. You served this country overseas. What's your response to that?
I don't want to dismiss that notion that people have that fear or that thought, because I want to welcome everyone to the table to have this discussion. However, when I hear that, I think we have to remember the reality of checks and balances in the government. We have to remember the reality of a constitution that is going to prohibit from some type of event like that occurring. And while it is a concern that was justified in the late 18th century, when we're trying to break away from British rule, and they're still loyalist in the country at that time, in our newly formed country, that's not really the reality that we are in now, Melissa. And I think it's just another excuse that some people like to use to avoid discussing the real issues, and that being, how are we going to prevent the next mass shooting? And that comes down to responsible gun usage and owners speaking up.
By the way, I don't know if you saw the coverage overnight of Gem City Shine. Dave Chappelle led a concert in Dayton, Ohio, in the Oregon District last night. Thousands of people came out. Kanye West, other people came and performed as a way to kind of rally Dayton and cheer them up after the mass shooting there. Dave Chappelle lives in Yellow Springs, which is a little town right outside of Dayton. It's about 15 minutes away from where I grew up, in the town of Fairborn, Ohio. And so, as we talk about this, I just wanted to make mention of that, because whether it's El Paso, Texas, or Dayton, or any number of other communities, Las Vegas, Columbine, so many communities now have been marked by this tragedy, and they're responding to it in different ways, you know?
Yeah, there's no really right way to respond when it comes to emotional response, because we all go through a different process of grieving and recovering and moving on with our lives. But you bring up a great point that so many communities are now marked with a gun violent event.
Including Jacksonville.
Including Jacksonville with the shooting at the Landing.
And people might not realize, Travis, the first mass shooting in America is thought to have occurred here in Jacksonville at the former GMAC offices on Bay Meadows Road.
Yeah.
So, several decades ago.
And Jacksonville is as prone to gun violence as any other city in America, as you can see with the increased violence we've had here in Jacksonville over the past few years.
Okay. Tom is on the west side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, first I want to say that we need to work on a common set of definitions to enable us to talk gun control or weapons control, however you want to say it. Because right now the legislature is talking about assault weapons, and they're including the Ruger 10/22, which is clearly not an assault weapon. But my big question for y'all right now is I've been advocating for luxury taxes for the AR and AK style rifles, and I was just wondering if this organization would support that.
Thanks for that. You know, that came up the other day when we hosted Congressman John Rutherford. He was opposed to that and laid out his reasons why.
That's a great question, caller. It's not something that we're opposed to. It's not something that we support. It's right now we are in a conversation, and all ideas are welcome to the table. I think that's something that is unique. That's something that our group has not discussed, and I would definitely be willing to take that to the group to talk about that.
One thing you have brought up, though, is involving gun dealers in this effort. Over the last week, I've received a couple of emails from gun shop owners saying that, you know, they're watching this closely. They want responsibility. They have a more nuanced opinion about a lot of this stuff than you might imagine. How do you involve gun dealers in this whole conversation, as you're calling it?
Yeah, great question. So involving gun dealers, again, it goes back to them being a stakeholder. So as a business owner, they want to have a revenue that creates a profit. And in order to sell weapons and to make that profit for their income, they're going to have to participate, because this is going to impact them directly. So we're welcoming them to the table. Again, they're part of the gun community, so we need their voice right now. We need them to speak up, because if we continue to see this dangerous, violent, and very tragic trend of gun shootings and mass shootings in the United States, they're going to be out of business very soon.
What about the argument that gun dealers might not want to close the so-called gun show loophole, this legislation in Congress, the Background Check Expansion Act? They might see that as affecting their profits, as you said.
It does, but I think that also feeds back into responsibility, and it's an ethics issue at that point as well. What are we going to do to be able to prevent that next shooting and remain left of bang? We're going to have to close those loopholes, and we're going to have point-to-point sales where there is an actual exchange of money and a weapon in a dealership, where it is an accountability issue, so we're able to track that weapon as well. But those gun owners are going to have to realize that they have an ethical and responsibility in this as well.
Jeff is in McClenny. Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Ross. How you doing?
Okay, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Great. I just wanted to talk about people. You know, I live in McClenny. It's more of a rural city right outside of Jacksonville. And, you know, I hear that a lot about, oh, they're coming for the guns. You know, they want to confiscate our guns. I don't really feel like that's ever going to happen. But I feel like the point missed is that people don't talk about the most dangerous weapons. And, you know, I'm sure that both of you would agree with me that we would like to ban the most dangerous weapons first. But, you know, the look of a weapon doesn't necessarily make it the most dangerous. You know, if you look at FBI statistics on how these weapons are used, more people are bludgeoned with hammers and bats, and way more people are killed with handguns versus these, you know, assault weapons. And I feel like the look of them and how they're used in these mass shootings, maybe more often, you know, I feel like if we're going to start taking guns away, we should start with the most dangerous weapons, and those would be, you know, small hammers and bats and handguns first. And then when you start talking about that, then people kind of wake up like, wait, I have a handgun, and, you know, I don't have an assault weapon, but I have a handgun. So that's what people kind of feel like, that when they say confiscation, it's not just those assault weapons.
Jeff, thanks for your thoughts. Travis.
Yeah, Jeff, and I think this goes to the previous caller as well. We have to be careful on definitions. What is an assault weapon? Is that a high-capacity weapon that can, you know, carry a lot of rounds? That's something that we really have to define, and I think that's going to be up to Congress to put into legislation is
Do
what that definition is.
A semi-automatic weapons ban, weapons that have detachable high-capacity magazines. There's been a push to have a special session on that in the Florida legislature, not likely to happen.
I do, Melissa. I do support that ban. And I believe that comes to the point to, again, in military service, we handle these weapons. We use them. And these are not weapons that I feel are going to lead to ending gun violence on our streets if they're in the hands of everyday civilians in the United States.
We appreciate your thoughts. By the way, let's let people know where you served.
Well, I've served quite a bit.
You've had several deployments, right?
I have. Seven deployments, four of which were to the Middle East, Japan, Italy, and of course, Iraq and those areas.
Okay. He's Travis Akers. He is a veteran. He's a naval intelligence officer stationed here in our area. He is one of the authors of the op-ed in Newsweek. It's live now at newsweek.com. Travis, thank you.
Thank you, Melissa, and congratulations on 10 years of success.
Thank you for that. Welcome back. Well, we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of First Coast Connect this week, and we wanted to start things off with a quick look back at how it all began. And it's all due to one very special guy, station manager David Luckin. Take a listen. David Luckin, let's take a little walk down memory lane to August 31st, 2009.
Was I here?
Oh, you were here.
Yeah, we were here. Just the three of us in those days.
That's right. When we launched this talk show right around Labor Day weekend in 2009, it was as bare bones as it could be. It was you and me, and we were lucky enough to have this volunteer at the time. He was an Iraqi war vet named Luis, who was just an incredible station volunteer, but that was it.
And that was the three of us. You were the host, I produced, and he ran the board.
Yeah.
And somehow we did it with just three of us.
I still can't believe we did it. I still can't believe it worked.
Who was our first guest? Sheriff Rutherford?
No, it was former Jaguars owner Wayne Weaver.
Wayne Weaver, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Melissa.
And you are our very first guest, so thanks for helping us kick this thing off in style. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
He was our first guest. And I don't know if you remember this, but the show was such an unknown quantity at that time that the morning of that Monday when he was scheduled to appear, he had actually forgotten about it. And I had to call over to the football stadium across the street. I got his secretary on the phone. And I said, oh, is Mr. Weaver on his way over here to be on the radio? And she said, oh, yeah, I think he forgot about that. Let me grab him and tell him to get across the street. So he literally made it into the studio with maybe a couple of minutes to spare. And I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I was so nervous because it was the first show. And I thought,
for sure,
if this doesn't go well, what a horrible way to begin things. But luckily, he made it over and
off
we went.
But we were so popular. He had us right top of mind. Yeah, we did good.
I mean, nobody knew what it was. I mean, that was the challenge of it in the beginning was it was this new show that nobody had heard about, and it was difficult in the beginning to convince people to come over and be on it.
Yeah, for sure.
You know?
And then we came up with all those crazy ideas of God squads and getting the mayor in every month.
Well, all of the greatest segments in the early years were ideas you pitched.
And stole from Imus and everywhere I could.
You did.
Because the God Squad was on Imus in the morning, and I thought, hey, we could do a local version. Let's get a local rabbi and a local priest and a local Protestant, and we're ready to go.
Right. That was just one example of so many great ideas that you would kind of come in and say, what if we try this? What about this? What about that? And I always say to people, you want to come to work every day with someone like David, because every day he comes in and says, what if we did this? And wouldn't it be cool if we tried that? That's the spirit that you bring to WJCT that is so uplifting and positive. That energy, it makes all the difference. It really does. I just want people to know that about you.
I appreciate the kind words. And I think we can blame Mr. Weaver for setting the standard for people showing up 5 minutes before. Which is still
right.
Happens.
That
every
goes
now.
On regularly, yes.
And it's like, oh, where are they? Where are they? And thank God we have Heather now, because she's much more serious than I was. I remember when we had Rutherford the first time, and for the bump in, I used Car 54, Where Are You? So we weren't quite as serious 10 years ago. And Rutherford had a biggest smile on his face. He couldn't believe we played that.
He was the sheriff at the time. Yeah.
Right.
Now the congressman. Yeah. It's been interesting over the decade to see people that had one job now have another job.
Right.
There's been a lot of change and movement over the decade.
And then on the other hand, you see the same players.
Yeah.
So much in this town where it's similar people each time. I often refer to Jacksonville city government as like Italy's, where every 2 years the old gang comes back in. And then in 2 years, they throw them all out. So
yeah,
it's been a great run, Melissa. But the main thing is we couldn't have done it without your leadership and your quality journalism and knowing how to ask intelligent questions. And it's been really, really fun. And I want to congratulate you personally. It's been a real pleasure, professional and personal, to work with you. This has been a fun run, and let's hope for 10 more.
Let's hope for more. I mean, I can't say enough good things about you, because you really changed my life, David. If it weren't for you, I never would have gotten this job. You're the one who encouraged me to apply for it. And it has just been an incredible ride. And so thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. And I love working with you every day. It's always fun to come in. We always laugh a lot. And then we get serious at about 9:02. And then we laugh again after the show. It's a good friendship and it's a good professional relationship. So thank you for making me look good.
Oh, believe me. It's not hard.
Okay.
Thanks,
yeah,
David.
There you go. My pleasure.
We love you, David Luckin. In a moment, Culpepper, as we look at the final week of the NFL preseason. We'll be right back.
Hey, Melissa, it's Heather. You know that redhead you see sitting on the other side of the studio window every morning? Well, I just wanted to say congratulations, and I'm so honored to be a small part of what you've been doing for the last 10 years. First Coast Connect's been my favorite show since I moved up here from Miami a few years ago. And I'm delighted to be able to work with someone I can call both a friend and a mentor. Here's to 10 more.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take off T-C-T.
Hi, I'm Angela Spears with Angela Spears Communication, a radio host in town. Melissa, congratulations. 10 years. You are amazing. Always bringing your voice, always bringing the news to people in our community, telling it like it is. Congrats on a decade.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact 358-6327 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
Thank you.
A murder in St. Augustine, a missing person from North Carolina, and a secret society housed in a castle. Coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with E.T. Malone Jr. about a murder mystery that took over 180 years to unravel. We'll learn about the Loxahatchee River Historical Society and discuss Florida's first professional football team. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Caller ID revolutionized how we deal with, answer our phones. But with the new technology of today,
I would say 99% of all the calls that come in for them are scammers or robocalls.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Robocalls versus caller ID. That story and the rest of the day's business news, the numbers from Wall Street as well, of course. Next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
More of us are bicycling to work, saving money, getting exercise, and facing a new level of risk on the roads. In New York, 19 cyclists have died this year. The mayor calls it an epidemic. What needs to change to make the roads safer for cyclists? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's the final week of the NFL's preseason and the toughest week for Jaguars head coach Doug Marrone.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Are you going to the final preseason game this Thursday? The Jaguars are hosting the Falcons. I know who will be there. Cole Pepper.
Yeah, good
morning.
Yeah, unfortunately, maybe. This fourth preseason game, you really have to dig to find the storylines because it's all about the bottom of the roster players, guys that fans really haven't had much of an emotional investment in as of yet. So we'll see how it all plays out Thursday. We're not going to see the starters. But the big story, of course, coming out of that game is setting the final roster. Mm-hmm. And this is a very difficult week on Doug Marrone. A lot of guys who we know will be on the team, that's easy. You know, Calais Campbell and mm-hmm. Jalen Ramsey and Leonard Fournette and Nick Foles. You know, we know these. The starters are going to be doing what we're going to be doing, watching and not playing in that game. And mm-hmm. since he took over as the Jaguars head coach, Marrone has always said that this time of year is the toughest for him because he knows how much the guys have put into trying to make the team.
I think people that are immune to that have no appreciation, you know, for what these people do. They have no appreciation for what goes on in their family. They have, I think it's cowardly, and I hate people like that. I mean, to be honest with you, I think that if you don't have an appreciation for it, if you don't feel bad about it, you really shouldn't be in this business. I really feel that way. I mean, I'm not an emotional person up or down, but this week is probably, you know, outside of anything happening in my family or things like that, this is by far the toughest week. I hate it.
Yeah, Doug Marrone is usually a pretty even-keel guy in press conferences. He's matter of fact. He's very forthcoming, certainly forthcoming in those comments. But you can just see the emotion in Doug Marrone every year at this time. He's been on the other end of this thing, being cut, being told, hey, you're not good enough, in essence. And he knows how much these guys sacrifice mm-hmm. physically, emotionally, and he doesn't want to just pass it off as something. He's not just cutting somebody saying, hey, get out of here. It's tough, and 37 players are going to hear that message from the head coach at some point following the game Thursday, probably on Friday for most of them. Then that final roster of 53 will be set, and the Jaguars will be preparing for the regular season opener.
They'll be off and running. Okay, so Thursday night, it's set, should be a pretty full stadium. You'll be there. And then we're off and running after Labor Day.
September the 8th is the opener. Jaguars and Kansas City Chiefs coming into town. One of the big questions we have right now is where do the Jaguars fit into the scope of the AFC South? And that may have changed over the weekend. The big news coming out of the weekend certainly is the Colts quarterback Andrew Luck announcing that he's retiring from the NFL at the age of 29.
O.J. Simpson tweeted about it even.
Yeah, O.J. was upset because of his fantasy team, and I'm not going to.
You won't get into that.
I don't want to get into O.J. at this point. I think he is probably taking the approach that a lot of fans were, kind of a sad representation for the Colts, because this was happening as the Colts were playing a preseason game. This word came out, and Colts fans were booing Andrew Luck as he was going off the field.
Right.
This is the guy who led them to the playoffs 4 years, their franchise quarterback, and he has been dealing with injuries for the past really 4 years, had to sit out the entire 2017 season, and Luck just said he couldn't continue to go on playing with the injuries and the rehab and the pain that is associated with all these injuries. With Luck, the Colts were a team to contend for the playoffs. Some had them as the AFC South favorites. Without him, don't expect too much, and that will benefit the Jaguars as far as the AFC South standings are concerned.
Let's hope so. Okay, quickly, college football. Let's talk about the Gators.
Gators open the season with a somewhat uninspiring 24-21 over the Miami Hurricanes. Offense didn't do a lot worth writing home about, but the defense did have 10 sacks. The Gators have 2 weeks to get ready for their next game at home against Tennessee Martin. Meanwhile, Florida State and Georgia open the seasons this Saturday. FSU faces Boise here in Jacksonville. After last year's disappointing season, FSU fans anxious to see if the Seminoles look any different under second-year head coach Willie Taggart. Georgia opens the season Saturday in Nashville against Vanderbilt.
Okay, last but not least, over the weekend you were part of the broadcast at Channel 4 for the Bold City Showcase. There was a lot of excitement around that.
Three high school football games broadcast live, back to back to back.
Yeah.
Over 21,000 attended the three games at Bowls. And Mandarin,
that's
Barter Trail, and UC
turnout.
All winning. Yeah, great turnout, especially for as hot a day as it was. But I would say, considering the success of Saturday's events, we'd likely to see more of this sort of thing in the future.
All right. Well, it's always good to have you every Monday. We'll be taking a break next Monday for Labor Day. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
You can catch Cole every night on our news partner, Channel 4. Follow him on Twitter at Cole Pepper. And that is our show today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. We value your feedback. Emails always go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tomorrow, a conversation with Senator Audrey Gibson on her push for gun reform in Florida. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for some music. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.